A solemn anniversary remembered in Israel.
In Jerusalem, Netanyahu visited the Iron Swords Monument, constructed to commemorate some of the roughly 1,200 people killed in the Hamas attack a year ago. Netanyahu quoted a verse from the Hebrew Bible as he said the nation remembered the victims and those taken hostage and would not be defeated.
A look at the massive amount of work it will take to rebuild Gaza.
As of July, the United Nations estimated an estimated 990 million cubic feet of debris.
Plus sour grapes for some French winemakers.
More than a third of all cognac, a type of brandy, is exported to China. The vine growers here fear they could soon be the target of Beijing's retaliation.
Today is Tuesday, October 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Monday night in Israel, the Israeli army said several projectile launches were identified crossing from Lebanon into Israeli territory. Sirens blared in Tel Aviv. Several incoming projectiles were intercepted above the city, while the military said others fell in open areas. Earlier on Monday, Israeli leaders marked the anniversary of the October 7th massacre, while Israeli citizens demonstrated in the streets to demand the release of remaining hostages. Foreign capitals mourned the dead, while Palestinians protested the ongoing Israeli occupation in Gaza. Zachary Goldman of Reuters has this report.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Monday marked the one-year anniversary of the October 7th, 2023 rampage by Palestinian gunmen that marked the deadliest attack on his country since its establishment. But in Gaza, a different sort of reflection. Monday marked 1 year since the attack by Hamas and other Palestinian militant groups triggered a devastating Israeli retaliation that leveled the coastal enclave with no end to the fighting in sight. In Jerusalem, Netanyahu visited the Iron Swords Monument, constructed to commemorate some of the roughly 1,200 people killed in the Hamas attack a year ago. Netanyahu quoted a verse from the Hebrew Bible as he said the nation remembered the victims and those taken hostage and would not be defeated.
We went through a terrible massacre a year ago, and we stood up as a people, as lions.
Near Netanyahu's private residence, families of those still held hostage took to the streets. Israel's President Isaac Herzog, meanwhile, attended a memorial at the site of the Nova Music Festival. More than 360 people were killed there and over 40 taken hostage. And in Tel Aviv, demonstrators created a human chain and demanded the release of the 101 hostages still held captive. But the fighting that began a year ago raged on. Israel mounted air and ground operations in Gaza, saying they were attacking Hamas militants and command centers. Hamas said it had fired a salvo of missiles at Tel Aviv. In the streets of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, residents like Abu Hassan Shaheen said they were yearning for a return to normality.
Before October 7th, one had dreams. Me as a father, I have 6 children. My biggest burden was that I provide them with homes, I find them wives. But after October 7th, this came to nothing. After 58 years of work for me, same as my father, all of it was gone to dust and rocks.
Palestinian health officials say Israel's air and ground assaults have killed more than 42,000 people in the coastal enclave in the last 12 months.
That's Reuters' Zachary Goldman with that story for us. Everyone in Israel has been affected by the last year of war. Many have lost loved ones. Others have had their homes and communities destroyed during the Hamas attacks 1 year ago. VOA visited some of the hardest hit sites. Linda Gradstein reports.
For Talma Atsili, it's still October 7th, 2023. Her son Aviv was killed as he fought hundreds of Hamas gunmen who stormed their kibbutz near Oz, less than a kilometer from the Gaza border. Aviv's remains are still being held hostage in Gaza, so a temporary grave has been set up for him at the kibbutz.
I can't even think of what will be here. both in terms of security and in terms of the emotional strength required to return to a place that has absorbed so much loss. I very much enjoyed walking barefoot, both inside the kibbutz and in the fields, and now I have this sort of feeling that the land here is soaked in blood, and how can I continue to walk barefoot?
1/4 of Nir Oz's residents were killed or taken hostage, and more than half the homes destroyed. In nearby Kibbutz Be'eri, more than 100 residents were killed, among them Hagi Avni, a father of five and member of the Be'eri security squad. His 9-year-old daughter, Eliel, writes his name on the wall of her former room.
I miss my daddy. I wanted to say goodbye to my house before they destroy it and rebuild it.
But many residents of Be'eri and other Gaza border communities doubt that they will move back in.
The question is how to live here with some kind of arrangement. Like with Egypt and Jordan.
A year on, hostage families still stage mass protest rallies demanding that the Israeli government bring back some 100 remaining hostages. Avichai Brodetch from Kibbutz Kfar Aza began the protest movement days after his wife and three young children were taken hostage on October 7th. His family was released in the November hostage deal. But speaking at the ruins of his kibbutz, Brodetch says Israeli society still feels the trauma.
As a nation, we have to remember this as part of the Jewish history to remember. But personally, if you ask me, I'd like to live my life, you know, just look forward, live in peace. You know, after we suffered so much, I think we have a good opportunity to do it now. You know, both sides suffered so much.
But a year later, a Gaza ceasefire and hostage release seem far away. For those in Israel missing loved ones and their lost communities, October 7th, 2023 is never ending. Linda Gradstein, VOA News in the Gaza border communities.
As the world yearns for a political solution to the war in Gaza, it's important to remember that even if diplomacy prevails and there is a ceasefire deal today, there are still years of rebuilding ahead. Ruby Mellon writes for The Washington Post. In her most recent article, she breaks down what it will take from repairing roads and clearing corpses to infrastructure and construction to rebuild the Gaza Strip.
Experts told us they laid out the reconstruction process in pretty much three steps. So the immediate need is, first of all, getting people proper food and shelter, just dealing with the general humanitarian crisis going on there right now. And then we would move into clearing rubble and finally, you know, rebuilding.
So let's take those down one at a time. Phase one is getting people to safety, essentially giving them a place to live, giving them basic medical care, sanitation, and really the crudest of infrastructure. What's involved in making that happen? How fast can something like that be accomplished?
Yeah, I mean, first, it's important to note just the general scale of devastation in Gaza. So nearly 2 million Palestinians remain displaced. Most homes, most roads, schools, hospitals, mosques, and churches are all either damaged or destroyed. And most people are living in either bombed out buildings or tents to begin with. According to a UN satellite assessment from September 6, 65% of structures in Gaza have been either damaged or destroyed. To go back to your question of exactly what that would involve, what it would involve in part is aid getting into Gaza. After Hamas attacked Israel last October, you know, Israeli authorities sealed off Gaza for around 2 weeks. So that severely limited the amount of aid that could enter. And even as crossings have reopened, restrictions have continued. So advocates are saying, you know, first we need more aid to be allowed in. But then even if more aid is allowed in, almost 70% of Gaza's road network has been damaged. So it would be actually hard to disperse that. So in reality, what it would entail is just a vast humanitarian effort that has yet to be conceived of.
And then phase two is clearing the rubble. And in the rubble, there are corpses, there are dangerous chemicals, there are unexploded ordnance, Israeli and Palestinian. So that's not a quick feat either.
No, in fact, you know, one organization, the Mines Advisory Group, told us that they estimate around tens of thousands of unexploded ordnances remain in Gaza. And then they told us that removing a single bomb can take more than a month. That's also what UN experts estimate as well. So, you know, we're looking at years, if not decades, of demining or getting all of these explosives out of Gaza. And then, as you mentioned, there is also this issue of the thousands of bodies believed to be buried underneath the rubble. You know, it would take time to identify the remains and properly bury them. And then there is just this general scale of the amount of debris, the amount of rubble. So some of it could be contaminated, you know, by things like asbestos or disease. If there are animal carcasses, you know, those can be vectors for disease. And there, as of July, the United Nations estimated actually an estimated 990 million cubic feet of debris.
990 million cubic feet of rubble. That's about 28 billion cubic liters of rubble. Do experts have any idea where it would go?
That is really the question. I mean, there are dozens of temporary dumping sites right now throughout Gaza, but ultimately you would need to take the rubble out of the enclave. And of course, that would involve negotiating with the border crossings, which are pretty heavily restricted at the moment. You could also recycle some of the rubble. So some of the rubble could be crushed and used to repave roads. That's what one expert at the UN told us. But ultimately, it's not really clear what the plan is for dealing with all of this destruction.
And the third and final phase is the actual construction, the building of the new Gaza.
Yeah, so it's important to note, you know, Gaza's no stranger to war's destruction, right? There have been wars in 2008, 2014, and 2021. So if the pace of reconstruction after this war, whenever it ends, if the pace of reconstruction mirrors those previous conflicts, the United Nations estimates it will take around 80 years to rebuild all of Gaza's destroyed homes. So not a short time frame at all.
So bottom line, final question, if the war were to end tomorrow, given the three phases we've talked about, how long do you think it might take for Gaza to be rebuilt and complete?
You know, I don't know if I can completely speculate, but just based off of what we've been told in the interviews that we've been done, it's looking like it's going to take the better part of a century.
Ruby Mellon writes for The Washington Post. Ruby, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Steve.
We're following these other stories from around the world. The failure of Myanmar's junta to end the country's violence, allow humanitarian assistance, and implement other elements of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations 5-point consensus will be the focus of ASEAN's summit this week in Laos. For the first time since the junta seized power 3 years ago, Myanmar will send a delegation to the summit. Florida is preparing for its largest evacuation since 2017 as Hurricane Milton, now a powerful Category 5 storm in the Gulf of Mexico, heads for the western coast of Florida. The storm's pending arrival follows the recent devastation left behind by Hurricane Helene. The Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine was awarded on Monday to Americans Victor Ambrose and Gary Ruvkun for their discovery of microRNA, tiny pieces of genetic material that alter how genes work at the cellular level and could lead to new ways of treating cancer. The European Union is bracing itself for retaliation from China after the bloc voted on Friday to impose tariffs on the import of Chinese electric vehicles, which Brussels says receive unfair state subsidies. As Henry Ridgewell reports, there's speculation that Beijing could target individual European countries that voted for the measures.
It's the end of a successful harvest in the cognac vineyards of southwest France, but the mood here is far from celebratory. More than a third of all cognac, a type of brandy, is exported to China. The vine growers here fear they could soon be the target of Beijing's retaliation after the European Union voted to increase import tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles, or EVs. Anthony Brun is president of the General Union of Cognac Producers.
Knowing that we will potentially be imposed with a tax of around 40% tomorrow, that will potentially mean the disappearance of this market.
France was among the EU member states pushing hardest for the tariffs on Chinese EVs after a year-long EU investigation concluded Beijing unfairly subsidizes the industry. Cognac makers say their potential exports are being sacrificed.
Because France is leading the way on this policy, they will seek to target a product that concerns France exclusively.
Germany, the EU's biggest economy, voted against the tariffs. German car makers fear Beijing's retaliation. Hildegard Müller, president of the German Automotive Industry Association.
The current decision could lead to new trade conflicts, to a spiral of protectionism.
China has already opened investigations into the import of European pork and dairy products. However, both Brussels and Beijing say they are continuing negotiations to find a compromise. Julia Poliskanova is from the Transport and Environment think tank in Brussels, which advocates for greener transport.
Ultimately, the EU market provides the opportunity for the bulk of Chinese EV exports. So China needs the EU as much as we need China. And that's why I think there will be some sort of friendlier retaliation or friendlier actions as such.
The EU argues that the EV tariffs will protect the European car industry, which employs 14 million people. The bloc believes the tariffs don't breach World Trade Organization or WTO rules. Again, Julia Poliskanova.
The tariffs are very differentiated compared to the company and based on the individual levels of subsidization. And I think that's what makes those tariffs actually quite compatible, from what I understand, with WTO rules.
The United States in August quadrupled its tariff on Chinese electric vehicle imports to 100% after announcing the tariffs in May. Canada imposed the same rate from the beginning of October, alongside import tariffs on some metals. China has filed an ongoing appeal against the Canadian measures at the World Trade Organization. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Haitians mourned the loss of family members and homes following a gang massacre in the western city of Ponsan. Phonice Pierre-Louise was there.
They started shooting at 1 a.m. in some areas, but the sound of bullets was heard in my neighborhood at 3 a.m. We left at 4. I arrived at 8 a.m. I don't know about the others. I came with my 3 children.
Gang members brandishing automatic rifles stormed the town last Thursday, killing at least 70 people and forcing 6,000 to flee. Grand Griff gang leader Luxon Elan took responsibility for the massacre, saying it was in retaliation for civilians remaining passive, while police and vigilante groups killed his soldiers. On Wednesday, Mozambique holds its election, and there are 4 candidates vying to be president. Some pledge to rid the country of alleged corruption and improve the economy, while others say they will end the long-running insurgency in the northern province of Cabo Delgado that has already displaced about 1 million people since 2017. Many in Mozambique, however, say they are more interested in a better life than who wins the elections this week. Miriam Diallo is VOA's Nairobi bureau chief, but today she reports from Maputo.
The same Frelimo party has ruled Mozambique in southern Africa since its 1975 independence from Portugal. Some say the country is doing just fine, including 69-year-old Argentina Bebe, who told VOA she's too old for change and wants continuity in presidential and legislative elections slated for Wednesday.
I'm not interested in change. I already know the people, but I prefer to continue the improvement of Mozambique.
Others, like 28-year-old Ernesto Cremildo Castigo, who works at a butcher shop, says he'll vote for change.
Mainly due to corruption, so that Mozambique can develop, so that society can feel more at ease in terms of justice, in terms of education, in terms of public transportation.
Aslak Orr, researcher at the Christian Michelsen Institute in Norway, has been doing research on Mozambique for 25 years. He says corruption does affect the daily lives of ordinary people.
You have the everyday corruption where people meet civil services and they have to, you know, pay little bribes in order to get their services out of the state or municipal institutions that they relate to, and that complicates things a bit.
Four candidates are vying for the presidency, including Daniel Chapo, the choice for the ruling Frelimo party. At a recent rally, the 47-year-old former radio presenter told supporters that peace and security for his country will be a top priority.
Because without peace, without security, there is no development. As I said here, we have our brothers who are suffering from terrorist attacks in Cabo Delgado.
The government has been battling an insurgency in the gas and oil-rich Cabo Delgado province, where about 4,000 people have reportedly been killed and about 1 million displaced since 2017, affecting multi-billion dollar oil and gas projects. Meanwhile, analysts say that one of Frelimo's biggest accomplishments has been ending years of its brutal war with the Mozambican National Resistance Movement, or RENAMO. RENAMO has since become one of the main opposition parties that came in second in the last presidential election. After the death of longtime leader Afonso Dhlakama in 2018, its newest leader, Osufo Mamad, accuses the Frelimo party of having no proposals to solve ordinary people's problems.
Vote for you have to have jobs tomorrow so we have good access roads. Did you hear me right? Your land is a rich area. You are poor. It's through Frelimo's poor governance.
The other two candidates include Lutero Simango, a 64-year-old and leader of the Mozambique Democratic Movement, and 50-year-old Venancio Mondlan, an independent who used to belong to the RENAMO party and seems popular among the youth. The National Electoral Commission met with international observers Friday to explain the voting system and answer their questions. The commission chairperson, Carlos Simao Matsine, said that all voting materials should be in place by Monday, and voting is expected to take place across the country, including in Cabo Delgado. 17.1 million people have registered to vote, 3 million more than the number was at the last election in 2019. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
Meanwhile, in American election news, we've heard accusations before about foreign governments trying to meddle in the American election by spreading misinformation and with other campaigns of deception. As the AP's Norman Hall reports, those efforts are also beginning to be seen in down-ballot contests as well.
Intelligence officials say foreign governments are targeting House and Senate races around the country in their effort to meddle with the American democracy this election year. Russia and China are said to have launched influence operations designed to help or hurt candidates in specific congressional races. An official from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence says both countries have zeroed in on races where they believe they have a national security interest at stake. The warning comes during a particularly tight battle for the House and Senate, where control could be decided by just a handful of races. I'm Norman Hall.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.